Hey there, welcome to Board Game Hot Takes. My name's Tim.
And this is Chris.
This is Adam.
And today we're going to be giving a hot take review of the game we just finished playing, Clockwork Wars. How hot it is, I don't know, but...
Vintage hotness. It's coming back around.
Back to the future. the hottest thing of 2015.
Before we get into that, though, we do have a poll question that I asked on social media. It's kind of an emergency poll question. I forgot until it was after my run this afternoon about 3 hours ago. So we've got a few responses, quite a few, actually, pretty good conversation going on here today. And the question I asked was, if you lost your entire board game collection, what percentage of it would you reacquire? And I probably should have posted a trigger warning on that because I have a feeling that that could really be painful for somebody that lost a collection at this point. But how do you guys answer that?
Wow, that's a tough one because there's a lot of games in my collection that I would want to have again, but how many would I actually go out and replace? Oof. I would probably estimate 25% of my collection I would actually go out and spend the money on again, because even the games that I like and that I care about, you know, they're expensive. You know, it's hard to get some of them. They're expensive. And so I don't know that I would reinvest all that money again. I think I would probably just really, you know, double down on getting the cops to find the dude who stole my original game collection, and then I don't have to worry about
Chris
it.
Chris is paying a bounty. That's what he's doing with his money.
Yes. Chris the bounty hunter.
That's probably a smart way to go. I think I have roughly 100 games, we'll say. I think it's in the neighborhood of more like 80, I don't know, somewhere in that neighborhood. So, man, now you got me thinking of the ones that I really want and really enjoy. I think there's maybe 10 that I would go and try and get again. So that's what, between 10 and 15%, something like that. I can think of, you know, some of the like Dune Imperium, or maybe I just go with Uprising, and then Eclipse Second Dawn would be one that I really, but would I get that one again? I play it so rarely. Maybe I won't even get that one. Battle for Roku gone. I can't even replace that one. It's like out of print, impossible to find anymore. So that one's out of here. So yeah, there's some games I wouldn't even be able to get back that I wanted. And gosh, yeah, I can think of maybe 10 to 20 that I would try to get back, and the rest I might just say farewell to and look for new ones.
Adam, Eclipse Second Dawn is actually one of the ones I was thinking about, because like, I love that game, but I've played my copy of it a grand total of one time, and it's like a $200 right. game. Am I going to go out and spend $200 yeah. again? So I hear you, man. I hear you.
I said less than 25%. I have a pretty tight collection as is, about 80 games. I counted recently, 80, 85 games. But I think I would only go out and reacquire the ones that are getting played a lot and will continue to get played a lot. And that's not a huge percentage of my collection. So I love yeah. every game in my collection. I'm happy to play it anytime. But some of them are for very specific situations. Maybe they only get played once a year or once every couple of years. So I definitely wouldn't reacquire those ones that I'm not playing a lot. And if I ever really got the urge, then I'd go back out. But I would expect it'd be about 25%, and then, you know, then I just slowly let some other things that were fun to experiment with and try out into my collection. I think a lot of my board game purchase history has been like, hey, I really want to try that game. I don't know anyone else who owns it, and it's on sale, so I'll pick it up. And then some of them have stuck around because I really liked it, but admittedly, some of these are just not getting to the table often enough for me to say I would immediately go out and pick them up again. Here's how a few of our listeners answered this question. Carson Mitchell said, honestly, my collection isn't huge, so I voted for 90%+ of it. I either play or plan to play the games I own while also being a bit of a treasure goblin and having a really hard time getting rid of stuff. So Carson thinks he's going to go out and reacquire most of it. That's crazy. I would read what Brian Chandler said, but I feel like I give him way too much time for my arch nemesis. So you can just go check his hilarious answer out on the Facebook poll.
We should all be so lucky to have an arch nemesis.
Meg said, I said half or more, but love 90% of the games I own. I just don't think I'd be able to stomach the replacement of all of them, knowing I'd paid double by purchasing them all twice. A game that might be absolutely worth it to me for $60 is harder to justify at $120, especially if I was doing that multiplied by my collection at large. Yeah, that's a super great point on that. And then over at Blue Sky, Jake said, no more than 1-2% right away, and then just get new games or rebuy some of my previous games as I find them in trade or on discount. Context, that would mean rebuying right. about 5-10 games from a lost collection of about 500, which is the most I could justify buying at once. Yeah, so that big collection. Paul Owen said, I think 10% for sure, maybe 20%. The thing is, I'm finding that there are a few games that we always go back to, and a lot of games are good games in their own right, but that we only occasionally go back to. And I think that'd be a key thing for me, is it a game that I'm going back and playing a lot. And then lastly, Games and Bourbon said, great question. When I moved, the movers mixed up boxes and brought the wrong ones to the dump.
Oh. Ooh,
so many games were lost, and I seriously could not even tell you what they were. So I'm with Paul, maybe 10%. Glenn, I'm really sorry to hear that. I kind of remember, this is Glenn from the Board Games and Bourbon channel, and I remember him having that posting about that on social media a few years back, and it just hurt my heart to hear about that. It's just so painful.
That's terrible. I did learn a new term, though. I've never heard Treasure Goblin, but I like it a lot more than Pack Rat. I think it's much, much more flattering to those of us that it applies to.
That's like calling a shelf of shame a shelf of opportunity, though, Chris. I mean,
yes, which is also great.
All right, well, let's jump into a description of Clockwork Wars.
In Clockwork Wars, you play as unique races of animal-human hybrids trying to control limited resources in a dystopian steampunk universe. Mostly, this is done by writing your troop placement orders on a sheet of paper and revealing them with the other players simultaneously. After the orders are revealed, troops are placed where they're ordered, and if you share a region with an opposing player's troops, then there's a conflict. The player with the most troops there will be victorious, barring some surprises brought on by their espionage cards, or due to unique units or generals having extra power. Controlling different types of regions will give you different benefits. For example, controlling villages or cities will give you more units to place in the next round, while controlling certain types of structures will earn you sorcery, science, or religion influence points, and controlling lakes or forests during a scoring phase will be the primary way to gain points in the game. After all combats are resolved, players will spend their influence points to pick up powerful discoveries or hire generals, but you have to watch out because discoveries are placed in a region, and if that region is later controlled by a different player, then they'll gain that discovery and you'll lose it. After 7 rounds, you'll perform a final scoring phase and add points from some discoveries and leftover influence points, and the player with the most points is the winner. Clockwork Wars was designed by Hassan Lopez and published by Eagle Griffin Games.
Tonight was our first play of Clockwork Wars. We all played a game on Tabletop Simulator. I think this game is out of print. It's one of only a couple of games that we featured on the show that was out of print before. But I warned you all that if you listen to our Games We Want to Play episode, you'll get a chance to hear what kind of games we're going to be reviewing this year. And this was on Adam's list. So that's why we all got to play it and why you get to hear about it tonight. So let's start with the gameplay and mechanisms of Clockwork Wars. I'll start us off by saying that I think this was a pretty interesting area control game for its time. And I'll get to one of my negatives and one of the things that felt dated in a bit here. But the thing that I thought was the most interesting was that where you deploy troops or workers or whatever you want to call them in this is pretty seriously impactful, because each of those things give you different benefits over the course of the game. Some of them are going to be what gives you more workers the next round. Like if you deploy to villages or deploy more, they're going to, you know, turn into cities and you get more workers there. Some of them are going to give you these research points that are going to let you buy technologies, kind of engine building things over the course of the game. And then some of them will give you victory points at the end of certain phases of the game. And that was pretty interesting to me, because at first I went like the technology route. I was like, hey, I'm just going to throw out to some of these places that are going to build up science and build up sorcery points. And yeah, I was the first one to buy one of these big technology things in the game. But I also was making no troops most of the game. I was making no victory points. So it was an interesting choice right from the beginning.
Yeah, and my interesting choice was to immediately double down on the spaces that several rounds into the future might get me victory points. So it was definitely impactful deciding where to put those troops, that's for sure. But I did agree that was an interesting part of the game. And one of the things that I found interesting about it was the fact that once you place those tokens, the workers, the warriors, whatever you want to call them, you don't move around a whole lot. They were fairly static. You could move some, but it wasn't like a lot of troops on a map game where you're constantly, you know, maneuvering your pieces around the board. Here, they more or less stayed where you put them for the most part, which actually, in a way, reminded me of another game, one of the older games we played, and I'm searching my brain for the name, Tyrants of the Underdark. Similar kind of thing. A little bit of the feel from that. Not in most of it, but in that aspect of the game. And then even more interesting, I thought, was the way that you actually went about putting those troops down on the map. And that was through a mechanism that I actually was really skeptical of at first. I'm like, this is going to be really annoying. But you have a pad and paper where you write down the spaces where you're going to put however many troops you... Well, first of all, you start with however many troops you have available to deploy. And then for each of those troops, you write down where you're going to put them. And then there's a big reveal and everybody shows where they're going to put their guys. So it's not like I put mine down and then Tim puts his down and sees where what I did. It's all simultaneous. And so that was, I think, one of the most fun parts of this game was the big reveal, because you really don't know until the reveal happens what your opponents are going to be doing. So you really don't know how those battles are going to look in the next phase of the game.
Yeah, that was cool, Chris. The orders, the deployment orders, is that what it's called? I think the deployment orders was one of the coolest parts of this game. And that's part of this whole phase structure of the game. I think there's, I don't know, four or five phases, and those are divided into some sub phases. And I thought those were all super neat, starting off with the spy master phase. I thought that was cool. There's five or six little abilities, starting with the first player. They get to pick one, and then it goes around the table and each person gets to grab one of these different little technologies. We were all going after the R&D one, which lets you get these espionage cards, which have these super sneaky powers that you can play at different parts of the phase, or different parts of the round, or different parts of the sub phase when it's applicable, and do some really sneaky kind of cruel stuff to your opponents. So I thought that part of the game was neat too, this whole spy master, in addition to all the other parts around. But what do you guys think about that spy master phase? I think Chris has some opinions about that.
Oh, the spy master phase, I thought it was okay. It was the espionage cards that I had issue with, which I will come back to later. But I did think, and this is maybe something that would develop on multiple plays, but I did feel like there were some obvious best choices for many of the rounds. Like there was an R&D card that let you pick two of the espionage cards and keep one. And the espionage cards, just, you know, spoiler alert, are crazily overpowered, I thought. But, you know, whether you agree with that or not, you know, that was a really good card to get. And so, you know, that's something that whoever was the first player that round would have a huge advantage. And then there was another one at the very beginning of the game that Tim grabbed up. Actually, I think Tim did, then Adam did when he was first player, then I did when I was first player, that lets you get a resource and make all the other players give up one of that resource. So having that limitation where only one person can do each action, I thought was, I didn't love that, but it wasn't terrible either.
I will say that I thought in the first round, when I was looking at it, like, this is a clear, there's a clear best option here. And so I took it again on the second round. And then I started to realize that it wasn't as valuable as I thought. And almost every round there was some decent choices. Even that R&D one, you know, you're getting one card out of it, which could be really valuable, but it was a little bit of a crapshoot. And so I'm not sure that there is a best choice there. And I think it's going to depend a little bit. You know, the one that lets you break ties is going to be really valuable if you've got somebody with a bunch of single, you know, workers around you. Then all you've got to do is send one worker in every one of those spaces. And if they don't counteract it, you've got some pretty big benefits. So I think that even over the course of the game was developing, that there was interesting strategy to make there, even if you didn't get the first choice. So maybe. But I think it actually led to one of the things that I found interesting and maybe a little bit dated about the game, is that the amount of variety in this game, you know, the discovery that you're going to find is probably a bit limited. Like those tokens don't change. So, those are always going to be the same five or six you're picking from. The generals, there's only three generals and there's only four factions, and the factions all have pretty minor asymmetric abilities with them. So just from that aspect, it felt like a little less asymmetry, a little less variety than you'd normally get. The one place the variety did come in, though, from what I could tell, the variety and setup is the discovery tiles, they're called. And that's where you basically, at the start of the game, there's three technology types, and there's only one card for each type in each era. So nine cards out, but a bigger variety in the box. You're going to get a mix of technologies every game. So that's where there would be more discovery every game to try to find the right combo of a couple cards that go together, or the right you know, kind of a fun one that just surprised people in that turn. But otherwise, I just felt like, you know, it felt like in a game you'd get published today, the generals would be a stack of cards and you'd put out a few of them. And then, you know, that maybe those tokens that you can pick from the beginning, there might be more variety. It just felt a little bit limited when there's supposed to be choices. The choices felt a little light. But before Adam jumps in there, I will say that I think there's almost, to some extent, I'm not sure it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it felt dated. But the nice thing about it is that you could actually learn what people could play. The intrigue cards is the other one I was going to say. It's only about 12 cards in that deck. It wasn't a very big deck, I think. And so even though there was a variety, Adam wants to jump in here.
Well, you're mixing up your terminology, Tim. Like, we knew you were going to do your kind of intrigue cards. They're espionage cards.
We're not playing Dune.
I think that's an advantage that there's 15 espionage cards, these sneaky ones that do these crazy things. So that you're going to have some awareness on repeated plays, the potential that these espionage cards can do. And then just to clarify, there's 45 discovery cards. Basically, those are the technology, the tech tree. So each game you're playing with 9 out of 45 of those. So that's going to rotate around a lot. But yeah, Tim, I think you're right. The factions are relatively, they just have the different special unique unit or a couple different unique units, which we didn't use to great effect today. I don't think any of us did.
I would disagree. I used mine like crazy. My hunter was awesome.
Is that, did he help you get that last place finished, Tim? Is that what you're saying?
Touche. So one of the other cool things I thought was when you buy those discovery cards, you actually put a little token that represents where that discovery is held. So it's like a special technology, or, you know, it could be multiple things that it's representing, but you basically put this little token out on the board as to where it is. And then all of a sudden that region now becomes more valuable, because if somebody goes in there and takes that region, they get that discovery card as well. And I thought that was a really clever way to escalate the, you know, the focus on the different areas. Why would I go after this city when I'm sitting at a city right now? All of a sudden there's a technology there that I could take over. It was pretty cool. Pretty cool way to handle those, instead of just one person gets it and it's their technology the rest of the game.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen more of those discovery cards, partially because it does create the variability, like you said, Tim, but also because I honestly didn't find the benefits from the discovery cards that exciting. There was, like, one of them was if you got 16 of one resource, you got a couple of points. Another one was that in a battle with another discovery token, you got a +1 or a +2 on your combat. So they tended not to be super dynamic, super exciting things, but maybe that was just because that was the draw that we had. They were certainly, you know, used appropriately. They could be impactful, but they just didn't feel exciting to me.
I'm going to have to agree with you, Chris. They felt okay. I wonder what's in there. Like you said, it'd be fun to go in there and kind of see them, the different techs that are available and how that can affect the game. So yeah, good point there. They were kind of just, okay, it seemed like. One thing I want to talk about is there's a few side rules in the game. And I thought those were all kind of interesting and added to the area control. So one of those I want to talk about was the attrition stage. So you can sort of cut off supply lines to different units that you have on the map. So say Chris had, I don't know, 5 hexes of guys in a row. Well, if I was to chop out that third hex, that middle hex, then the last 2 clusters of guys that he had in those separated 2 hexagons, they would each lose a unit representing a lack of supply getting out to those guys. So I thought that was kind of neat. And I also thought this pollution phase at the end of the scoring round was kind of a nice way to mitigate just piling your dudes in these scoring regions, a la something like El Grande. And what you did in this pollution phase was, so you need, you have to have control of lakes and forests. And so if you had 5 guys in a forest, you could get 3 points. But then at the end of that round, you have to get rid of all the guys in that territory down to 1 guy. Same for lakes. If you had 2 guys there, you get 3 points. But then you'd have to reduce the number of guys down in that region down to 1. So it was a way to prevent. There was a blurb in the rule book about that you know, that was sort of the pollution, the toxic effects of exploiting the land and mining this. And, you know, so I thought that was a neat thematic way to reduce troops and keep those areas viable for other people to come in and take over.
Yeah, those were great, great elements that did really make the game feel a little bit more, you know, like there wasn't a clear strategy on where to put all your people or what to go after. Like I said at the start of the conversation here, choosing where to put your people every round was a pretty fun decision. There was a lot of variety to go for. And you mentioned that, you know, like where you kind of write, mark down where you're going to place people and then reveal it at the same time. That was great because it was all simultaneous. It didn't slow down the game. That phase went quickly. Everybody's making this decision together. Probably the longest thinky decision in the game. And you're all making it at the same time, reveal at the same time. So there's not a lot of downtime here. But the other reason there's not a lot of downtime is because it's a whole bunch of little phases over the course of the round. And this is the other part that I would say felt a little bit dated, because games aren't doing this too much anymore. And I think for a good reason. Well, Lords of Ragnarok did it. But here, it was pretty fun. They were quick phases. They were impactful, fun decisions. This reminded me more of La Granja, which is a game that I really love that has a whole bunch of little phases in it. But each one is a little separate mini game that's fun to get into. You can't wait to get to that phase. What card do I get to play? What dice do I get to draft? This one was different little mini games, but they're all little fun pieces of the puzzle. I just think that, you know, there's an element to that that requires somebody to be tracking and kind of managing the game and walking through it every round, which Adam did for us tonight. That was awesome. So thanks for doing that, Adam. But, you know, it's a bit dated. It just feels a little more clunky than your modern game, which is usually like people are just taking turns round after round after round, and then, you know, the game ends. And so a little bit of a upkeep with it.
What was that game we played? We did a review of it. It was quite a while ago. It was the one where Adam had his drop ship and it was killing everybody. I felt like it had a lot of that multiple phase kind of thing.
It was the Shimp Phillips one, Circadians.
Yeah, Circadians, Chaos Order.
Yeah.
Chaos Order. Yeah, yeah. It felt a little bit like that to me. That was another one that had a lot of phases throughout the play. Robotech Reconstruction was another one where I saw some of that. But that does feel a little bit clunky. Wasn't too bad in this game, I didn't think. One thing I actually did like a lot that I felt was pretty impactful and a lot of fun, added some real flavor to this game, was, I don't know what they call them, the generals, or I forget what the technical, the generals.
Yeah, the generals. Yeah.
They were these three cards that came out. One was the Leviathan, one was the Steam Tank, which Tim had, which was a awesome looking steam powered tank. And the other one was called the Guardian. And they were these major characters. I'm not sure what, you know, you'd call them, but they were like mine. I had the Leviathan. It was a one-time use. And it was right before the battle phase starts, drop it into any battle you're involved in and you win the battle. Period. Doesn't matter who else is in there. Any other special units can be in there. Any other generals can be in there. And you win the battle. And so it was only one-time use. So it couldn't be overused. But if used strategically, then it could be super exciting. And I got the Leviathan early on in the game and then just kind of hung on to it until, you know, it was a good time to use it. And you also got 1 point per enemy unit that was destroyed in that battle. And so I used it in one where I think Adam had six guys. And actually, I think in retrospect, that's probably what got me the win in the game, was having those extra 6 points. I would have not won otherwise. So, you know, those could be used to great effect. I thought those were a lot of fun, really kind of wild cards.
I think, again, as you play the game more and more, if we ever play the game again, you're going to realize how powerful those things are and when to use them in the right spot. And you're right, Chris, I think that guy did get you the win because he took out six dudes in one swoop. So that was awesome. I want to go back to the phase structure you guys were talking about. I love games that have a snappy phase structure. So another one I can think of is Smartphone Inc, where you're just doing the, I don't know how many phases, 8 phases in a round or something like that, but you whiz through them all so quick. And it's really just the order that you're doing things. And then I love the interplay, like something you do in, I don't know, phase one affects something that's going to happen in phase four. So I like that sort of dynamic. Eric Lang, I feel like, does this in a lot of his games where you have this combat round, and really it's the combat can be divided into, so think of Rising Sun, and you're going to battle in territories 1 through 8. Those are basically 8 phases of a combat round, where something you do in the second combat is going to affect the 7th combat that you have, and you're still manipulating things through the course of that combat phase. So I enjoy, he does it like in Ankh too, same thing. Anyway, I enjoy games with this phase structure if they're used correctly, you know, not like Lords of Ragnarok. You can have all these different clunky things going on, but this is succinct and snappy little phases where it just keeps the game going and organizes the structure of the game in a way that's pretty neat to me.
Actually, Pan Am has it too, now that I think about it. So I think basically what we're saying is that, contrary to what Tim said, every modern board game essentially has this complicated phase structure.
Yeah, well, speaking of Rising Sun, since you mentioned it, there is one element of this that reminded me of Rising Sun. I wonder if Eric Ling even took it from this, but that is that when you were placing your workers, you could choose to put them into regions, but you could also put them onto this council card, which was just kind of a single standalone area control thing. And whoever controlled it during a score phase would get some benefit in the first era as one thing, and second era was something else, third era was something else. And they were cool benefits. They were pretty fun, but it was a nice little puzzle too, because you'd be like, oh, I know Adam, he's going to be trying to protect his region down here, so I can throw just a couple guys up in the council and fight for it. So it was a fun choice to make until like the end of the second round, when there was clearly no way for me to win that without committing everything to it. And then I kind of just gave up on it. So, but you know, it was fun. It was fun. It was like the shrines in Rising Sun, where you kind of can throw your Shinto up there and potentially protect them. And that's an area that I think there's variety in this game that we didn't get to see. And that would be fun to see multiple, you know, like over the next game, what are the rewards on the next time you see it?
So the one other thing that I wanted to mention, and you guys were razzing me about this at the beginning, it was the espionage cards. And I'm gonna walk this back a little bit because of the point that Adam made about there being so few of them that you could know basically what's in the deck. You know, if you played this game, I mean, heck, even after one play, I think we saw most of those cards, so you could have a fairly good idea. My argument was that these cards are overpowered, that they are too game changing, that you can have your game completely ruined by one of these cards. And I'll just give a couple of examples, both of which were used on me at the end of the game in the last round when we were getting ready to wrap up. One of them was every opponent that has workers on a lake space, which is one of the main scoring spaces, loses all their workers. And so you can completely wipe out an opponent's almost their complete scoring ability if they're, you know, doubled down on lakes. So that's huge. You're wiping off potentially a large number of their workers. And the other one was one of your opponents doesn't do any production of recruitment of fighters or workers on their cities. And that's where you do the majority of your recruitment, is on your city. So I had like 8 guys that I was going to recruit, and I couldn't recruit half of them because of the card. So those got thrown at me at the last round. It was pretty tough. I mean, that was definitely, it was definitely harsh. And I thought on a first play, it's like, you know, if I hadn't had a dominating lead in the game already at that point, I mean, really sort of a embarrassingly big lead. Then,
oh my gosh.
No, I mean, but as I'm thinking through it now, you know, if you're aware of that and you know that those cards can be played on you, it dulls it a little bit. It's maybe not quite as bad because you're forewarned. You know that someone can do this to you, so maybe it's not as bad as I'd originally thought.
Chris, did you also really hate that espionage card that you played on me that took the council from me right in the first round of the game when I was, or the first scoring phase when I was ready to get that big prize?
Oh, it's horrible. It's a horrible card. It was a terrible card to play on you.
So one of the espionage cards I had let me go through the entire espionage deck and look at all the cards and choose one. So that was fun. I got to see what was in there. One of the espionage cards cancels the effect of the espionage card just played. So that is also in there. So you can have that as a protector, which is pretty neat. And then I saw what Chris, you had, or Tim had, the 2 points per city at the end of the game or something like that. And then I also saw Chris totally misplayed the 2 points per battle 1, where he could have got 6 points. So Chris just does not know how to use these espionage cards is the final verdict from me.
No, I get Chris's feeling here in that they can be very swingy at the wrong time. And it's painful when you're set up with a strategy. And there was a time in my gaming life that I would have hated those. I would have really been frustrated by them. But here they were mostly just fun, even when they were played on me. And the fun is, one, they were pretty thematic. Like that one that killed all the people in the water was like poisoning the water source or something like that it was called. And not only did it kill all the people in the water regions, but it also subtracted points from people with cities next to the water sources. So it's super thematic. This is where some of the artwork came in the game. Mm-hmm. It's where some of the theme carried through. And I honestly wish there were more. It's, of course, it's nice to know those things, but it's almost frustrating that there's that few that you have to plan around them every time. Mm-hmm. And then I have to be thinking about it like, oh, shoot, I probably shouldn't commit to those lakes because that card might come up. It's more fun when it's just like you don't know what's going to come up any given game. So I would have liked to see more variety personally, but I totally get where you're coming from there. Well, let's jump into the theme and production of Clockwork Wars.
It was really neat. I thought it was a really cool production. The art on it was absolutely awesome. And the theme and the art, I'll take sort of hand in hand, I thought was actually really kind of clever. It was this combination of steampunk, which I always find delightful. I love steampunk as a style. But also, it was the concept of it was that human beings created these weird mixed race, you know, half dog, half person, half rhinoceros, half person. So you have these cards with these steampunk characters who have like the faces of dogs or the faces of rhinoceroses or, you know, the monkeys. I mean, it was just really kind of whimsical and dark and goofy. And like one of the cards that Tim played or Adam played, I forget who, it was like a minecart full of monkeys carrying rifles and wearing helmets. I didn't know what that was all about, but it was pretty hilarious. And they were fun to look at. The art was very nicely done. The other parts of the production, you know, the terrain tiles, I thought were pretty standard terrain tiles. There, I believe, in a video that I watched, there are minis for the three generals, and then there are tokens for most of the rest of the things. And I think the main workers are just little wooden discs. So nothing super exciting there. I think really the thing to talk about in the production for this game is probably the art. And I thought the art was a lot of fun to look at.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. The art was pretty neat, especially on the cards there that, the espionage cards had some great art on it. I liked the little, you could tell it's a little retro-y, but it has a cool little design on it. Every steam tank I have seen, though, has a bendy little cannon thing. And I think that was one of the main complaints when the game came out, is that all of these steam tanks had a bent nose and it made it look kind of goofy, which is unfortunate. But maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong about that. There is a version, like Chris was talking about, that comes with the minis and painted minis. You can get a version with the painted minis. There's a couple in stock on Noble Knight for like $95. So this game is out there if you're interested. It looks like it's, you know, there's not too many left. But great production. The art, I think, is cool. I like the tiles. I like they're clearly labeled. You know, so a village has this V2 symbol and, you know, all these tiles are just easily labeled and identifiable, which you need that for when you're doing your deployment and where you're going to put your guys. So easy way to identify that. The little chits for the different characters look pretty neat too. So yeah, pretty retro-y, but pretty nice all in all.
Yeah, again, a thing that was like just a little bit outdated, like feels like just before the era when board games really started. I mean, this came out the same year as Scythe and it came out the same year as Blood Rage. But those two games were huge standouts at the time when they came out. And compared to other things in the era, I think Clockwork Wars was probably a little bit more typical. The artwork was great, but, you know, having all of your workers just be in little tokens, just, you know, and standees for a lot of the other like characters and things like that was just, you know, just a tad outdated. That said, I think the user experience here was great. The way that the kind of the sideboard that tracked the rounds and tracked the points was all really clearly laid out. They had some nice player aids, at least in the mod that we played. I'm not sure what comes in the box there that helped with some of the scoring keys and things like that. And I thought when I first saw the board laid out, I was like, oh, I'm never going to be able to tell these regions apart, but it came very clear quickly. I think there was enough visual distinction, both with colors as well as, you know, some of the kind of the geography on them that made it pretty easy to tell what you were playing with. So playability wise, the game worked great. All right, well, let's jump into our final question. That is, would you request to play Clockwork Wars again? I'll start here. I would request it. I like this game a lot. It was a lot of fun. I think there's a lot to explore here. I think it took us a few rounds to really kind of get into what was happening. And I think by the time we got into the second or third round, I was really digging it and having a lot of fun with the decisions on it. I think there's going to be some crazy, wacky stuff that happens that you can't account for. So just got to expect that. I'm used to that in these types of area control games. And I think it's a nice fit into this, you know, the Eric Lang trilogy and the Matigo trilogy of games. So it's just a nice little guy that kind of fits in that mix of just fun, crazy stuff happening, big moments, big cinematic, epic things that occur on the board. I'd like to play this some more. I think it'd be really fun. I wouldn't go searching it out, I don't think. It feels a bit outdated. So there's something about a game that just like feels out of style that makes it a little bit harder for me to get excited to bring it to the table, and will probably be harder for me to get other people to play it with me. But if I saw this on a friend's shelf, I would absolutely say, that looks like a fun time. Let's get that again.
Yeah, I'm going to say I probably have 10% less enthusiasm about it than Tim did. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I don't know that I would ask to play it again. Maybe I would, but I really did have a good time. And one of the things that I think does recommend this game is that it is a pretty quick play with a pretty intuitive rule set. It was not exactly a light rule set, but it was pretty intuitive. And there was some fun there. And there was that aspect of the reveal about where you're putting your troops. That was fairly unique in terms of how these games play, these troops on a map games. So it definitely has some stuff going for it. But I felt that same out-of-datedness that Tim was talking about. And there was enough stuff in there that felt a little bit lackluster to me, like the discovery cards and maybe the espionage cards. I'm kind of taking back my complaint about. So overall, I would happily play it again. Maybe if there wasn't a lot of other options around, I would ask to play this one instead of something, you know, even, you know, something less desirable. But I don't think I'd go searching it out either, but would be happy to play it.
I'm pretty much with you guys. This was on my games I want to play. I think Tim mentioned that earlier. So I was pushing to get this one played. I have been eyeballing this one for a very long time. When I first got into board games and, you know, really got into them in 2015 or 2016, this was kind of one of the games at the time that I had my eye. I heard a few good things on, heard a few good things about, but it kind of just fell to the side and I never got it played. So I was happy to get it played tonight. I would request to play it again. I had a lot of fun playing this one. Am I going to go seek it out? I don't know. If I found it for a good price, looks like you can get it used in Europe for €55. So maybe if I move to Holland or the Netherlands or Dutch Landovia, I'll pick up a copy of this one. But you know, I don't think I'm going to buy it for $95 from Noble Knight. But I had a great time playing this one. And yeah, I'd love to play this one again if I ever had the opportunity. So yeah, great time playing Clockwork Wars.
This is an Eagle Griffin production, and they tend to do these occasional like huge deluxe editions of some of their games. So let's pull Ian O'Toole in here, replace all those little tokens with, you know, with nice miniatures and maybe you can pick it up for $150.
Right. But the more I look at the card art and some of the tech art, it's pretty good. It's really cool, yeah. Actually, the more I'm looking at the art.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to replace the art. One final thought, though. I just think it's really interesting how games can feel out of date. It's like this, the technology of games keeps progressing. And over time, things that had seemed exciting just don't seem that exciting anymore. And even like, I'll take one of my favorite game designers, Eric Lang. I mean, I'm absolutely in love with his game designs, especially Troops on a Map. But when we went back and played the Chaos in the Old World, I think we felt overall fairly, you know, lukewarm on it. And we all enjoyed it, but it didn't feel, it felt out of date compared to his other designs. And I just think that's interesting because it doesn't seem like game design would be something where that would come into play. But I think we've seen time and time again that it really does.
Yeah. Great insights, Chris.
Yeah. Interesting point.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, that'll wrap up the conversation on Clockwork Wars. We'll be jumping into some games that have been on our table right after this. All right, welcome back. So what I've had on my table this week, well, last week, and I mentioned it briefly in last week's episode, but I got a chance to play Tricarion Legends of Illusion. This was designed by Richard Amon and Victor Peter and published by Mind Clash Games. I mentioned it just briefly in our conversation last week, but I'll go into a little bit more detail this time, but not too much detail because there's a lot to cover here. But the general gist of the game is that a famous magician is getting old and he's ready to retire. And so a bunch of other magicians that aren't quite at that same level, they want to prove themselves. They want to become the heirs to his fortune and to his tricks. And so they're going to try to put on the best shows and impress this famous magician. And the reason it's called Tricarion, by the way, Chris, you asked this at one episode and I kind of just made something up, but apparently he had this Tricarion stone, which is this magic stone that helped him with some of his tricks. And so one of the resources you can pick up over the course of these game are these little Tricarion shards or these little yellow, like amber looking tokens that you can play. So there you go. There's the theme. That's where the name comes from. But like most Mind Clash games, it's heavy and there's a lot to do in the game. So I'm going to give just a really quick gist on it, so you kind of have a sense on how it plays. The good news is that it uses some tried and true mechanisms. The most common one being worker placement. Now at the start of the game, you start with a player board that has your main magician token on it. And so this is one little worker disc you get to use. And then you'll also have one assistant disc on there, but then everybody gets to recruit one special assistant that may be a special type of worker. They kind of have different focuses, different abilities, different artwork on these sideboards that you put in, but each of them are represented by a disc. And so you start with a few discs at the start of the game, and they might have a power on them. Like the main magician has a +3 on it. And then, you know, the basic kind of assistant just has a +1 on it, and then the stagehand might have a +2. So you kind of have a few different levels of power. At each of the different regions on the board that you're placing your workers, they have a little market. The first person that goes there gets to take whatever power their worker does, but then adds +2 to it. And then you'll get to do a certain number of actions or certain power of that action based on adding those two numbers together. But the more people that place in that region in the round, the power will go down, the kind of the built-in power, even to the point where it subtracts from your main power. So if you're the last person to place in a section of one of the four spaces in one area of the board, you might have your magician, which gives you +3, but you might lose -1. And so it only ends up being a 2 power there. There's only a few regions of the board, so pretty quick to go through. One is a market where you're going to get the supplies. And this is going to be a good indication of how overly complex the game is. So the market, you're basically going to be buying supplies that will help you make tricks. And tricks are things you have to acquire. So you first have to acquire tricks, and then you have to manufacture them. And then later you'll produce them on stage. But to manufacture them, you need some supplies. And there are 4 level 1 types of supplies. There are 4 level 2 and 4 level 3 types of supplies. And in this market at the start, there's all 4 of the main level 1 type of supplies are there, the basic supplies, right? The easiest ones. So when you go to that marketplace and use your power, one of the actions you could do with the market is to buy one of those supplies. You don't take it off the board, but it just means it's kind of like that's a catalog you can order from. But if you wanted a level 2 supply, you can place an order for it. And that means it goes to a sideboard and it will replace one of the level one supplies in the next round. So you basically have to pre-order in advance, a round ahead, the supplies you're going to need for the next round. But it will basically take one of the level one supplies out of the catalog. So if somebody else needed a level one supply in the next round that was going to be replaced by it, it will no longer be there. And they would have to go back and order one for the next round. So that's kind of the level of complexity you're dealing with here, where it's like this tight market. You have to plan ahead, sometimes rounds ahead, to get something done. You have to pay coins depending on the level that you're going to use there.
Wait, Tim, I thought you didn't like games where you have to like plan ahead around.
No, just chess. Chess is too much for me.
Ah, okay, gotcha.
So anyway, you're going to get supplies. You go to another space where you can recruit more assistants, and you can basically buy these tricks that you're going to build. And then finally, you're going to go to a place. There's multiple other places, to be clear, but the kind of final part of every round is you're going to be able to place workers out into the stage area. And if you place your magician there, you're going to be the one that's actually putting on an act. So when you put your magician out, you have to pick what day of the week you're going to do it in: Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. If you do it on Thursday, it's worth less points. If you do it on Sunday, it's worth more points. You kind of, depending on the time of the week, it's more valuable. But complicated, if you put your magician up there to put on an act on a day, then you don't get to use its +3 power for a worker placement space. So there's all kinds of complexities that will remind you a little bit of Anachrony, where you have to, you know, like choose based on the type of work or where you're going to put it. It gets a lot more complicated than that, to be honest. Putting on a stage thing, you got to first put your tricks out into the stage you're going to be performing on that day. Other people can put tricks there as well. And if they match up, if they create links, then you get special bonuses. So all kinds of things going on. We played with a couple expansions, one that's built into the main game that you just can add into it, a module that was called the Dark Alley expansion, that also added these kind of upgraded cards you can buy that are going to make your assistants more valuable. Oh, I forget to mention, the way you place your workers is you have a handful of cards. So you basically all face down place what location you plan to put your workers, and you reveal them all at the same time. And then in turn order, you start picking a worker and putting it onto that location. So you might beat somebody there and they wouldn't know you were going to be going there before them. So that was pretty fun. A little bit of a reveal that happens there. So when you go to Dargali, you can buy upgraded cards that don't not only let you, you know, use those locations, but they might give you another special bonus when you go there. And then we played with this Academy expansion where you can actually like teach tricks. So you can, instead of just performing the tricks, you can go to the school and you can teach them and get revenue every round. You can upgrade your tricks so that when you perform that type of trick, it gets better. There's so much stuff going on in this game, and it's very complex, but I will say it was a blast. It was so much fun. Intense planning, but when you got to perform one of these tricks, get all the points for it, it felt so rewarding to get all this done. The tricks are these big piles of tricks of different types, and you don't get to just pick from a market when you're buying one. You search through the whole stack, and they give you a little catalog. Everybody has their own little player book where you can look through it and look at all the different tricks in it, what the costs are and stuff like that. So it's a lot of planning. Sometimes you're planning like 3 or 4 rounds ahead of what resources should I get now that I might be ready in a few rounds to buy this trick and perform it. But only one person is going to be able to buy one of those tricks over the course of the game. So if someone else beats you to buying the trick you've been planning for, you can't perform it anymore. The tricks are represented by suits, these little tokens that have a suit on them. And when you can create a trick, you only get 2 tokens to represent it. So you can only perform it twice, in which case you'd have to recraft it again before you could perform it again. So lots of challenging things to go through. This is like viticulture on steroids, where you have like 4 different things you have to do before you could ever do the thing you're trying to do in the game. I thought it was awesome though. Super fun, super heavy. It took us about 4 hours to play our first 3-player game of it. A little bit of teach on there, and it was my first play of it. So, you know, I probably slowed things down a little bit, but I did think it was well worth it. If you want a heavy, reasonably heavy game, this game is beautiful, great production, really fun, tough choices with it. What do you guys think? Does Tricarion sound like something you'd be into?
I'm on the fence. I mean, I definitely would like to try it, but you're scaring me off a little bit with the high intensity and rules overhead level.
Yeah, this is one I used to own, the deluxe edition, the collector's deluxe whatever edition, and the production on it looks so amazing. The board looks beautiful. Everything looks gorgeous, but there's so much stuff. Like, any is a Mind Clash game. Any Mind Clash game just has an abundance of stuff. So that is kind of scary. It's kind of scared me up. But you know what? I'd love to give this one a try, reserve an afternoon. I'd love to sit down just because it looks amazing. I could see myself getting a little frustrated. He sounds like viticulture on steroids. Sometimes that's a little frustrating, building up to this thing, trying to get that, whatever, that fancy wine where you need to combine a white wine or red wine or get this other thing. And it takes forever to finally get 3 points. And so sometimes that could be a little frustrating for me, but I got to give this one a try at least once. So hopefully I get the opportunity.
It was a mistake for you to sell that deluxe edition, Adam, because this is like the other Mind Clash games in my collection. It's a game that I'll probably, if I ever play it again, it'll be like once or twice ever, but there's such a work of art and such a masterpiece when you get to actually get them to the table and teach them and dig into them that I think it'd be a game that I would probably keep if I owned it. On the other hand, if I lost my entire collection, I wouldn't replace any of these Mind Clash games because they've been fun to explore, but you just don't get to use them enough to make them worth the value they are. So it's an interesting trade-off with it. But I do think you guys would probably, I think you'd enjoy this one. I think you'd like digging into it.
So Tim, I noticed that this game is from 2015, which is the same year as Clockwork Wars. And I was curious if you felt any of that datedness in this game the way that you did in the one we played tonight.
No, I would say not at all. I think this is a game that could have been made this year. But I think it was an exceptional game ahead of its time from a production perspective for sure. And generally from a mechanisms perspective. And I don't know if that's a good thing. This is like one of these super heavy Euros that we don't need that many of, but there are some people that are huge fans of them. And I think to be honest, it probably could have been slimmed down 3 degrees and it still would have been a great game, but I don't know that either. Maybe that's part of what makes it fun to explore is how heavy it is and how rewarding it is when you actually get to pull off the big, you know, kind of the big final trick in the game.
On my virtual table this week, not on my real table, but on my BGA table, is a game that I've been playing a lot of. And by a lot, I mean like 10, 15 games of this going at the same time because it is just that light. So we're going from Tricarion Legends of Illusion, which BGG rates at a 4.25 complexity, which may be close to the heaviest game we would have ever played if we played this one, to Lucky Numbers, which is a 1.11 complexity rating. This game was designed by Michael Schnacht and published by Ravensburger. And it's almost mindless fun. It's just thinky enough to make it enjoyable to actually feel like you're playing a game and not just tic-tac-toe. This is a simple 4x4 grid. And each round, you either take a clover with a 1 to 20. There's two of each number, 1 to 20. You either draw a tile with a number on it, or you pull a number off of the table that's been discarded by one of the other players, and you place it somewhere in your 4x4 grid. And in this grid, you have to have the numbers go in ascending order from top to bottom and from left to right in any column, any row. There always have to be ascending numbers. So the trick is to place the numbers in the right spots so that when the new numbers come in later, you have spaces that can be filled in and you don't block yourself out. So it really is that simple. It's an addictive little game. BGA makes it even more addictive because you can just like fly through this one. My wife loves playing it, so we'll sit down and play a couple of games of this sometime. She usually kills me like she does on most of the games we play. And it's a nice little palate cleanser when I'm in the middle of a round of turns on, you know, Tapestry and Agricola and, you know, name the other heavier games that I'm playing on BGA. And then I breathe a little sigh of relief when I get to a couple of games of Lucky Numbers and can shut my brain off for a minute or two and then come back to the heavy stuff. So lots of fun. It's a very enjoyable game.
So Chris, have you played this one, the physical production? Because it looks kind of cute. It's got these clover shaped little pieces that you put on a nice little mat. Have you ever played the physical production?
Nope. Just played it on BGA. And it doesn't look like there would be a lot to the production because, like you said, it's just a bunch of little clover tiles and a little play mat.
And how did you discover this one?
Interestingly, this is probably the only time I can say this. My wife introduced me to it. When I introduced her to BGA, we started playing Azul together. And I don't know where she got this one, but she started playing this game and then challenged me to it. And I got hooked.
Nice. Yeah, this game looks cute and fun. It seems like it'd be a fun little. How long does it take? What do you say if you're playing it real time? It's like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that?
5 minutes. Yeah, it's a 5 minute game. Yep.
Well, on my table has been Gnar. This is a game from 2023 designed by Thomas DuPont with beautiful art by Carrion Antoine. So Andy Schwartz, I keep talking about him. He also introduced this one to me when he was here a couple weeks, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. I don't know how long it was ago now, but he brought this game with him too. He insisted that I should play it, and I'm glad that he did because it's a fantastic little game. So it's a quick little engine builder, cute little player mats, and there's Vikings, right? So that's going to be fun. So all you're doing there is three cards, three little Viking cards that you start with in your hand. You have a couple Vikings that start in your tableau, and this is basically a little tableau engine builder. So you play a card from your hand into a column that matches the suit that's already out there, or you start a new column if that suit is empty. And if you played a purple card, then you take the Viking that's in the purple column. So not the purple Viking, you take the Viking that's in the purple column underneath the main player board. Well, before that, though, you get to do all the power. So you say you play a purple Viking in a column that has four other purple Vikings. Each one of those has a symbol at the top of that card. You get all that bonus stuff from each of those symbols all the way down. So that's cool. So you basically have like five columns of awesome tableau-age bonuses going down. Every time you play one of these cards, you're getting all kinds of stuff. So that includes a track that's going to give you more points at the end of every turn. It includes you get these little helmet things or these little wristband things that you can apply as wild cards or use them to buy other stuff. So it's great. And then instead of doing a Viking card, you can buy these, I don't know, they call destination cards or location, something like that. So there's these bigger bonus cards. There's two sets of them. There's the cheaper ones, and then there's the more expensive ones. And usually those are going to give you points or some powerful little engine building stuff. And this goes at the top of your little player mat. And these activate in a neat little way too. So three other little columns, and you can get little bonuses from those too. Anyway, it's a quick game. Once you get to 40 points, that triggers the end game. The next person gets a chance to match or beat you once you've crossed the 40-point threshold, or all the other players get one chance to match or beat you. But the fun part of this game is you have to pivot. So in order to buy those destinations, those ones that really give you the most points, you have to pay for those with the Vikings that are in those columns. So, the decision gets excruciating. Are you going to use all of your four purple Vikings to buy that great card that's going to give you 9 points and maybe seal the game for you? So at some point you kind of have to pivot from playing these cards in your columns to turning those into points. And that's a fun decision because it becomes like, who's going to make that first move? Who's going to start going for that race to get the points? Is the right card up there that you need to turn your weaker columns and use some of your little skulls or bracelets to purchase this thing and make it happen? So I had a blast playing Gnar. I think you guys would love this one. Have you guys tried this one or heard anything about it?
I've been seeing it on the BGG hotness lately, and I literally went to go look for it and I couldn't find it because it's spelled K-N-A-R-R, which I expected to be G-N-A-R-R for some reason, but that's still strange. So if you're looking for it, that's how you find it. But anyway, yeah, I've seen it on the BGG hotness, so that's why I was pretty interested in hearing about it tonight.
Yeah, I'm about in the same boat as Tim. and this one definitely sounds gnarly.
Oh, man, Chris. Coming up with some gems tonight. Yeah, it's a great game. It's quick. I think we'd love this one. Plays at 3 or maybe 4. And I think 3 of us could get this one done in, I don't know, 15 minutes. Maybe that's optimistic. Probably take us like 45 minutes to play this thing when it should be really about a 15-minute game. I think Andy and I played it. We played two or three rounds of this one in a half an hour.
Well, what was a little unclear to me, but with your description, was that, and the nice thing, Adam, is that that was a pretty clear description. And so this is the only thing that was unclear to me.
Mm-hmm. That, yeah, lucky.
That is that with a card game like this and kind of a central board, you know, and it looks like a couple other components, is this like a Brian Brew weight game, or is this like a typical trick taker weight game, or is this somewhere in between there?
Much lighter than Brian Brew, about the weight of a trick taking game. It's just
okay.
Maybe even simpler than that. You just you have three cards in your hand. You play one down, you get the bonuses, and then you can use your bracelets to do stuff. So there's, you know, there's not much to it. You can never have more than three bracelets or three helmets. I forget exactly what those do. I think the helmets are like a wild card, and the bracelets you can do, I don't know, something cool with them. And that's really it. Really, it's just when you're going to pivot from getting all these bonuses from playing a card down to when you're going to buy those destination cards, whatever they're called.
Right on. Yeah.
Simple. It's simple, super simple, very lightweight, but very thinky, very fun decisions as far as when you're going to make that pivot.
I kind of love this resurgence of small card games, a variety of styles, but my family was out for this weekend. We played games all, we must have played 30, 40 games this weekend. And the ones that were just a hit with everybody and I really enjoyed as well were simple things like Scout and Six Nymph and Sea Salt and Paper and Nidavellir, you know, these games that are just like, just card games or just slightly bigger than card games. Mm-hmm. And they can be such a fun time. They're so easy for people to get into. And once you get into the groove of them, just, you know, lots of fun decisions to make, even with the slight components on them.
Yep.
All right, cool. Well, that will wrap up this week's episode, except, of course, we had a great listener leave us a review. So I'm going to read that to you right now. I know it's crazy, right? Crazy that we're still getting reviews every week.
Great listeners. Great listeners.
Great listeners. Thank you for listening.
This was a 5-star review left by Evan17 on Apple Podcasts. The headline was Honest, Thorough, and Relatable. And the review said, the fresh hot takes on games helps give a great honest impression of the games. They feel more relatable than many sponsored reviewers. I've only listened to 10 episodes since I found them a couple days ago, but I'm sure to visit the backlog. I know these podcasts take effort, but I'm very happy that they go above and beyond to deliver great reviews. Well, thanks, Evan. That was so nice of you after just 10 episodes. Please don't delete your review after you listen to a few more. Well, that will wrap us up this week. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on Blue Sky as well as on our Facebook group if you'd like to interact with our polls and discussions. Until next week, take care, everybody.
Good night, all.
Bye-bye.
The first option I gave was 90% plus almost all of it, and 10% answered that. The second, oh my God, I just deleted the option. What did I do? I just deleted the fucking option in here. Oh, geez. Well, now I have to just delete the poll at this point.
Oh, Tim. Undo. Oh,
jeez.
Control Z. Some stuff up.
I can't control Z.
You can make up some user comments. You can.
So I'm just not going to read the poll. I'll just say what some of the people asked on here. Now I got to delete the poll. Jesus Christ. All right. Well, let's jump into a description of Clockwork Wars. All right. Well, let's jump into
the game that was so good. We can't remember what it was.